R E C. Recovering. We're recovering from LA. When we travel, it takes us a week or so to.
Oh my goodness.
So you probably don't know anything about that because you're traveling all the time. But for us, it's like. Well, we drove down to LA, so it's like a day drive. But we have like kind of routines at home in terms of like lifting, getting Frank in and out of stuff.
Uh-huh.
That when you don't have the routines, it's like about five times harder.
Because
we have like lifts to get Frank in and out of things.
Wow.
And we rent a hospital bed. So we have to set that all up when we get to the hotel. And, you know, it's just everything's different. It's a shower instead of a bath. And it's, you know. So we're pretty much heaps on the floor by the time we get back.
when did you get back?
It will be a week ago tomorrow. Yeah. On. In. One.
Is. This. Your. F.
I. Is this your first time? T. O. Touring. Is this your first time touring?
No. Well, I don't drive. So whenever I tour, I'm never free to see places unless people can drive me or unless I can take a bus or train. And when I'm doing shows, also it's very hard to get away. You do your sound check, you perform, and you leave town. And this time, this is one of the more relaxed times I toured. I was staying with a friend who drove. She took me a few places. You know, it's been more of it's the first time I've kind of enjoyed California. Normally it's like, oh gosh, it's just all these cars. This is the first time I've like talked to people really and stayed a little while, so really nice.
Where have you been? Where have you been?
I have been to Chrissy Fields, that's in the Presidio, right? No.
Yeah.
Presidio, Pacific Heights, Presidio. I went to Berkeley for a little while yesterday for the first time. That was really cool. I just saw a little bit of it. And
Marin.
Oh, yes, Marin, that's right. We did the Sweetwater. And so we I got to see a little bit of the town, and it's very different. It's very different from the East Coast, so even the smallest details seem really different.
When? How? How so?
It's kind of like the cliche they say, like everything is more sunshine. People are more sunshiny. Like you walk, things just seem more spacious and relaxed or happy or peaceful or something like that. I can't put my finger on it. I keep watching and going, this is really different. This is
in New York City is like a B I big M A mall.
Yes, with a big overcrowded mall where everyone's rushing to get from store to store.
Well, it always feels, whenever we go to New York City, it feels like you're not really outside. Even when you're outside, it always feels like you're kind of in this thing.
And the suburbs in New York, it's almost like it's people are like passed out from the stress, whereas it's like they're so dull. Like there's no flavor in the suburbs. But here it seems... Well, I don't want to say that. There are some nice suburbs, but it just seems like, I don't know, really nice, the suburbs here. The suburbs don't seem to be that different from the city. That's the difference, you know. It's like more congruent or something, so.
Can you talk about your G R A grandmother that you wrote the song about?
Oh, wow. Wow, good question.
That is my job.
You did exceedingly well. Oh, my goodness. My grandmother was born Johnny May Armfield in Savannah, Georgia, about 100 years ago. And just watching, it's a whole generation if you think about the civil rights and even just a sense of the world and then seeing different generations go forward as far as discovering their sense of self-worth. And my grandmother had 7 children, and through the generations, you know, it was because her life was very hard, even though her children were successful, you know, one became a doctor, one became a this, one became a that. Through the generations, it's been a question I feel, or since I am part of that, for my generation, or me, the member of this generation, it's been a question of kind of reaffirming my inherent goodness, my inherent greatness, not because I have a degree or not because I sing well or not because any of those things, but really feeling equal on the inside as my taking responsibility for my sense of self.
E-N-O, enough, feeling enough.
Yeah. And so as I began to really claim that, I don't think my grandmother ever felt enough through her generation. And then when you look at her life, and actually it was really interesting. My grandmother's family had this huge pecan plantation, which was kind of rare for African Americans at that time. And I think my grandmother was learning disabled, which also kind of back in those days wasn't diagnosed. And this white man down in near Savannah one day came with the paper and said, "See this X on this paper? This contract says you gave me your plantation." And of course it wasn't true, and of course it was an X, but of course she had to give up her pecan farm. And that kind of sense of not being able to take a stand or not knowing you could take a stand. I believe that memories and events are even in ourselves. I think it's really, I think the same way we inherit, you know, genes about our eye colors and all these kind of physical things. I have come to believe very deeply that we inherit the impressions and beliefs of our ancestors. And when we begin to heal or shift those beliefs, we're able to shift that for generations to come and also send it backwards, like pay it backwards.
Yes. Frank always says that you can change the past by how you live in the present.
Exactly. Yeah. So every time I sing that song, I'm celebrating Johnny Mae because I think she's really standing in that.
People did not get that when you first started talking about it.
Wow.
They wouldn't get that he really meant that, like literally,
right.
that's true.
Right.
But it seems like it's more like there that people are more accepting of that.
It's even for me, it was kind of like, but when I really began to examine, like, who am I and why am I, it was kind of like a strange thought, like, is it because I've inherited certain, it was a strange realization. I didn't like read it in a book or decide that's a cool thing to think. It like really became my live experience.
Like a P H O, a photograph. Where you would have an experience of like a photograph actually appearing to be different. Something from the past because of the way Frank was looking at himself in the present. In the P, in the PA, in the past, I thought I was ugly. Frank thought he was ugly, and then there was a point where he decided that that wasn't working for him. It wasn't getting him what he wanted. So he thought, I'm just going to start pretending, faking, the way I want things to be. And so he started thinking of himself as beautiful. And within days, people started saying, what did you do? You look different. And then he noticed that even the actual photograph that people would, you know, look at before and think that it was like, you know, an ugly guy, would say how good looking he was back way before he thought that.
Oh, my God. I can see that. I can see how that's like it's so amazing. Our spirits and our minds.
And then he said after a while he forgot he was faking it.
Right.
And he started believing it.
Wow.
Like D.A. Dave.
Now we'll have to even rewind to the before and during. Oh, wow. Wow.
How did you RECL reclaim your enoughness?
Wow. Another tremendous question.
I am not L. E. Leno.
No, you're not. Oh my goodness. Being able to really. Every time I sing that song, when I start to even write that song, you know, the things that, even though I was writing this song, like if I could go back in time and tell my grandmother when she was younger, you know, Johnny May, like we have to get out of here, Johnny May, come on, we got to shake things up. It was almost like I was telling myself that in the present, like, okay, Trasiana, you know, we got to shake things up. You know, if you stay here like this, you're going to die like this. And it was this parallel of even every time singing that song, writing that song, and then affirming, like, we are beautiful. You know, like, not from an arrogant, like, even saying that, it's like, we're beautiful. Like, we're programmed to think, if we say a compliment to ourselves, like, it's arrogant or vain. But, like, actually really saying that and believing it and saying it again and saying it louder.
Everyone is beautiful.
Mm-hmm, exactly. But not everyone really thinks they're beautiful. Not everyone really feels they deserve. Or knows what does that mean to be beautiful? Like they get scared. Like, is it just, are you saying my hair? Are you saying my shoes? What, who is everyone? You know, really that whole sense of self acceptance. And so, deciding like, you know what, it was time to really do this. And it's scary and it's different. And can it be done? Can you believe it? Can you not believe it? But really I decided like enough was enough. So I had to become enough and even keep faking it or keep trying until it became stronger and stronger.
B. R. E. W. R. E. S. Responsible for it. Being responsible for it.
Exactly.
L. O. T. Lots of people don't think, don't want to be responsible.
I know.
Why? Why is that?
I don't know. I mean, I think there are many reasons, but I think that when a person takes a stand for being responsible, the vibrations of it can somehow like catch people or spark people or inspire people to all of a sudden kind of, it's like lighting a match or like lighting a little flame. And that's why that song that I wrote for my grandmother, as it became a song about myself and then about where I came from and then about where I really came from, which is part of humanity, it to me was more and more of setting a bigger and bigger fire, like to get everyone to feel that vibration. Mm. And interestingly enough, whenever I perform, wherever I go, that's the song that people really respond to the most, you know, and you can kind of feel people get it somehow. And I think sometimes they get it in ways that they don't consciously like decide, oh, this is what I'm getting. But that feeling of it's time to be enough. And it's a joyful thing. It's easy. It's great. It's, you know.
Like I A S asked the M U musician after the G I gig. Is this when we were in LA? You asked them, the various musicians that played in your band, and you asked them to talk about their experience of it. Mm. Like I K I kid N A. Oh, Frank kidnaps the musicians that play in the bands previous, because we're usually the last band on the bill.
Okay, so they all stay.
So his band is huge, and it's made up of some of the people that just came to be in Frank's band, but a lot of the people are people that played in the bands previous to us that really, this was their first contact with us. S. So they did not have any idea what it was going to be like. And I think a lot of they'll say that the freedom, that they were moved by the freedom and the feeling that everybody is like a long friend, that the way everybody treats each other with that with a certain kind of acceptance and kindness or something. They were amazed how T.I. tight the band was.
Wow.
Everybody listened to each other, and there was a freedom, but everybody was like together as if they knew each other so well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think because truly, at the end of this day, or at the end of the bottom line of this whole story of life, is that there is no separation. You know, we keep thinking we're separated by families
exactly.
or backgrounds, but like if like the most quiet truth is that we all are part of the same fabric, you know?
Yes. How did your M O mother B A M O D E model E F affect your C O N C E concept of beauty? How did your mother being a model affect your concept of beauty?
I think my mother being an African American woman affected my, it's almost like the model is almost like the last thing on the list. You know, being at the time that when she was a model, there were very few African American models, and her goal was to also really use that as a means to give us the opportunity to get, you know, exposed to different things. But she didn't really stress or underscore the physical. That was like when she came home, that was the last thing she ever talked about. She didn't like that culture of everything on the exterior. And then, you know, moving into the world as a person of where people are looking at you just on the outside, that is that's not a winning ticket. So I think maybe it was an extreme of not even like focusing on the outside at all, not letting people, you know, judge you or tune into what people thought about anything of where they liked the way you looked, didn't like the way that you looked, whether they looked at you and judged you for one thing or the other, kind of blocking that out and not not paying attention to that. Because at the end of the day, you look at magazines, you look at TV, there are very few African Americans that, well, things have changed a little bit over the years. So there are very few African Americans that you really see being celebrated. So I think her making us focus on the inside was very probably, I think she did it more because she, moving in that world, saw that that wasn't a winning ticket.
M O V, moving to F France. How did that affect you?
That probably was one of the biggest things, biggest events. So I think it affected me in every single way. And I think, in fact, that's why I named my CD Songs of a Prodigal Daughter, because I don't think I would have become the person I became had I not been able to go away and become who I am and be nurtured from different cultures. I could come home again, because I always have considered myself to be, you know, a citizen of the world, a human being, but also an American. But moving to France, I think, freed me to see different cultures, freed me to look at the world differently, to meet tons of different people with different languages, and to not be defined by certain stereotypical limitations that cultures put on you. If you're this or you're that, that's how you behave. I had no boundaries as far as defining myself, the way I dressed or the way I spoke or the way I behaved. And when I would come back to America, a lot of time to visits, people were very puzzled by me for a long time. You know, they couldn't understand why my hair was a certain way or I spoke a certain way or how I dressed or I talked with an accent. Like everything just, why did I play the guitar? If I was a singer, why didn't I just sing? Why was I writing songs? It's like every single thing that I was about seemed to be deeply questioned and puzzling to people. And yet I'd go back to Europe, I'd go to Africa, and people were like, oh, yeah, of course. So.
S-T-R-A-N. Strange. That's strange. The difference, the different cultures, the way people would look at you here. I am a I r air f an Air Force brat.
Okay.
So Frank grew up living all over the world, too.
It's very different, huh, coming back?
Yes. N, A, R, R, narrow.
Yes. Very Sometimes, very narrow, yes. But, you know, I think that the world is getting to be a smaller place in some ways. And I think that narrowness is having to shift. And I think that with the internet, with just the world way that countries depend on each other, I think that narrowness, because you know what's interesting now? People don't question what I'm about so much anymore. Mm. You know, and now a lot of the things that people hated, like, what is up with your hair? Or why do you play that daggone guitar? Or why do you have that funny accent? Mm. Like, those are the things that people actually like now. So, I don't know.
P-E, people, T, told one of our guests the G U I guitar is for M A L male. Who was that?
Was that Cat? Bell, Sunbell.
Oh, Sunbell. Yeah.
Bell the cat.
Her. F. Her father told her that when she said she wanted to play the guitar. It's not for girls.
Wow.
Girls don't play the guitar. Player. Gave her a horn or something.
Oh,
told her to play that.
A French horn.
Oh my goodness. a French horn. That's for girls.
We can not M make this stuff up. Then she was H I T hitchhiking. Oh, and she told the story to somebody that had picked her up, and it turned out he had a guitar. Was it a he or a she? He. Oh, he brought her a guitar.
Wow.
The guy who was giving her a ride stopped at a store and bought her a guitar when she told him that story.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. How did you S-T start to sing?
I just decided. I always wanted to sing, and when I was being trained, I was trained in France at the conservatory as an actress. And so, as an actress, they always train your voice to also be able to resonate well on stage. And the more we would train my voice, you know, for diction and all that, the more I decided that I just had to make sound, even though I loved acting and I loved all of the theater and all of that, that just singing notes was something that I loved. So I kind of did it I threw myself into it. And then as I began to study more, practice more, perform more, then I would get bigger gigs, get better tours, get to travel a lot. You know, sometimes they'd say, oh, do you want to go to Morocco and do a show for a month, or do you want to go to, you know, Senegal and do a show? And so each of these places I would go, and I'd be able to really then refine my repertoire, study other people's music and their ways of singing, and to practice a lot with whatever musicians I was touring with. And it just became a process of doing it, as opposed to studying for many years and then performing. The performances and the need to perform well then would kind of define what I worked on as homework, so to speak.
Mm. You? Do? A? R? E? G? U? Regular? S? Show? In? N? In New York?
Now that my CD's done, I'm doing a lot of touring also, so I do, I have something I do called Diaspora Soul, which was something I really felt strongly about, because a lot of times artists will have a show and their fans come, and then the fans go and the artists go, and there's never an exchange between the other artists and themselves, or really sharing their audience with other artists. And I wanted to create something that was more of a community base, more kind of an environment where when everyone came to the venue, everyone felt part of everyone else's artist, and everyone else, even if they didn't know each other, they felt like they were deeply committed to the community. And so that's been great, because it's not, I don't just feature the same type of music. I'll have, you know, African music, I'll have some rhythm and blues, I'll have R&B soul, I'll have folk, I'll have, I sing and I also host it. And it's a really special thing, because people come thinking, I've never heard this type of music, I don't like this kind of music, and they walk away loving it. So that I do in New York for every 4 to 6 weeks, and then also now I'll do spot shows in New York, and then also I do a lot of touring now to start meeting other crowds.
Do? Do you? T? A? Talk? No, tape those shows that you do?
Sometimes, and sometimes I don't. It just depends. But some of them recently have been taped.
I? M? F? L, E, A, leading up to, oh, asking if we could get copies to play on Lover. That's
sure,
what he's leading up to.
Sure, you can. Awesome. Awesome, awesome. I have, it's very recently, I've had several shows filmed, and then I'm doing one at Aaron Davis Hall, which is a kind of big venue in New York, October 1st. And that will be filmed. So we'll have things to choose from to give to you. Excellent.
I want everything. Don't see, don't choose.
Okay. All right.
We will give it a R-E regular, our regular slot. We would give it a regular slot on Lover.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah. Okay. You got it.
He's pleased. I am doing the series at Burnt Ramen. There's a an underground punk club in Richmond, California, which is kind of north of here.
How far? Like, is it?
Oh, it's not far.
So it's part of
like 20-minute drive.
Oh, it's part of San Francisco.
Yeah, it's kind of, you know, one of the last places where you can get a cheap place.
Oh, excellent.
And because there's like refineries there and stuff like that.
Okay.
But anyway, this there's this underground punk club. It's never been legal, but But John, who's a guy we met at a music show in North Carolina, and then he came out here and he ended up wanting to live here, and his whole thing is like, don't work, you know, just find a way to live without bank accounts and all this stuff.
Oh my goodness.
So he found this guy whose grandmother had bought him this old produce market so he could do a recording studio.
Oh.
And it was all funky, and John knew carpentry. So John said, can I live there if I, you know, fix things up, and I could book bands on the weekends and charge them $50 and give you the money. So that would be instead of me paying rent. And so Mikey, the guy who ran whose place it was, said, sure. Well, it turned into this, like, very popular place that's been going for years, and all the punk club bands come from all over the world to play at this place. And it's always John schmoozing with the local cops that keeps it going, you know. It's like, okay, what do you need, you know? Okay, we'll keep them off the streets and all that stuff. But from time to time, it gets shut down if it's, like, a new chief of police or a new bunch of cops or something.
Oh, my goodness.
It recently got shut down. And so John said that all these punks watch Frank's show on TV all the time, because we're on, like, all the time on the public access channel.
My goodness.
We're on every night of the week, but we're like the late night thing.
Wow.
Because they didn't play anything. And we had, like, you know, we have almost 300 of this show.
Oh, my goodness.
And so Frank said, how about if we replay these shows every night? So it starts at, like, 1:30 in the morning, and it's a 2.5-hour show.
Wow, fantastic.
So people come home from the clubs, and they turn it on, because they always know there's going to be something. Frank's going to have something, you know, that's good.
Wow.
And so it's a popular show. So John got this idea. All these punks would be coming up to him. Hey, man, I saw you on TV. Because John would be on it from time to time. He plays in Frank's band, and we would play at Ramen and stuff. So he thought, everybody wants to be on TV. So he asked Frank if Frank would consider hosting a regular show there just for TV. So we got this regular gig. Frank said, if my band can be the closing band.
Right, so you do
it. We have a monthly gig.
Oh,
know?
Fantastic.
And, yeah, so that's, we're just into the, we're doing one on Thursday. So he gets guest bookers. Sometimes Frank books him, sometimes he gets a guest booker. So you book the show, get three bands, and then us. And there's no paying audience, but people can invite people.
Fantastic.
So it takes, you know, it's a kind of a low-key thing, but everybody, it's fun.
Awesome.
It's on TV, yeah.
It's interesting, when I was with Steel Pulse, and I would hear stories about how they started out, reggae back then was kind of, in England, didn't necessarily have a following. There weren't reggae clubs, actually, back then. And what they did was, the punk scene was very hip back, I guess, in the 70s. And what they would do, they would open up for punk bands. You know, the punk scene was body surfing, throwing things. And people would say, you guys are going to play what? And they would come in the audience, and they'd say, please don't throw things at us. We're not punk. We're going to do some songs for you. And it was the most surprise. People would never believe, like, why is this reggae band playing for the Clash and all these other audiences? And that's how they started their following. Actually, it was punk fans who started liking reggae. So.
Wowee.
Yeah.
Like, was this, did you say you were doing that?
I was with Steel Pulse a couple of years ago.
Yeah. Well, we were in the late 70s. We did a show that opened for all the punk bands in San Francisco.
Okay.
At the Mobile Grounds. We had the same experience. It was like we would be the early show every Saturday night. We did it for 3.5 years.
Wow.
We were the H.I. hippies, right, that they were A G against. We were the hippies that the punks were against.
Right, 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 right.
So there's like 30 of us, and we did this thing, the Outrageous Beauty Review.
Oh my goodness.
It started out as a one-night thing, but it, you know, there were a lot of people into it, so the guy said, announce it's a regular show, you know. So, okay, you know. So Frank was the director. But it was a takeoff on a beauty contest, but the emphasis, rather than on beauty, was on outrageous. That was the first thing. And Frank ended up having to plant people when it was a contest because he didn't feel like people were being outrageous enough, the real contestants.
Right.
So we told the real contestants, I've planted contestants, but you don't know which ones are not the real contestants. The plants can't win, but you don't know which ones they are.
Goodness.
So you have to be more outrageous than everybody else.
Oh, that's great.
So this was like an 8 o'clock show at this punk club that nobody ever came to. Well, the place was like, you know, 500 plus people, you know, rows of press. We used to do shows for like five people, you know, so it was
good.
Like, Because that's, we made the announcement, it's a weekly show. So then we're opening for punk bands every week. And again, it's like this, you know, we're just like this group of 30 people. This is like what we do, and Frank called it a show. You know, this is what we do at home, and Frank called it a show. And but there were certain bands that were more aggressive than others. So like, for example, when we would open for Black Flag, they would just literally throw things at the stage, you know, bottles, bones, whatever. Right. So we figured, and the cast was intimidated by that. So Frank figured out what to do. He had us wheel him to, like, you know, off to the side, but on the stage in the front, and he would do this. Right back at the punks. And they didn't know what to make of him. You know, what the hell is this guy? What is he doing? You know? And so they'd shut up because they would just be calm. And so the show would just go on. Frank was just like there doing that while the show was going on. And that's the way we dealt with them for years, just like that.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness.
The go-to guy.
The go-to guy. How? Did you get that them? How did you get them to not throw things? Oh, no. How did you get these guys? How did you get these guys?
Through very good karma, I think. Very good destiny. Because when I travel and I'm an independent artist, I can't bring the same band everywhere. So when I knew I was coming to San Francisco and I had some shows, a friend of mine, Melissa Rapp, who is a great singer-songwriter, I met at South by Southwest, said, you have to call Eric. Eric, you know. And so I called Eric, and it was just perfect in every way. I was just truly blessed. And so right away we hit it off, and we've done some shows. And then he said, well, we have to pull Dave into it. And so it just was just like that. And so... that's what I've found doing it this way. When you get the right connection, it just clicks, and it kind of really forces you to be very pure in the music. You can't get into acrobatics, you can't get into ego, you can't get into anything but like really being present 100% in the music, in the moment, in the music, and it's been awesome.
F-L-E, flexible.
Mm-hmm. Like the bamboo shoots that they say, right? You know.
Are you S T I still A F afraid, Dave?
Well,
That's
a good question. I don't know. Certainly that's something I deal with on a daily basis, I think. But hopefully as I mature and develop as a person, I'll get over that fear. So.
Why? What are you afraid of?
I'm a little bit neurotic, I think, and I have to remember, like, so much, because I play different instruments, and there's, like, different keys and different notes and different things to do that I, there's perhaps pressure or something, and then I start panicking. Because I figure, like, how am I going to do it all, and how am I going to do it all really well? And so I guess it's kind of like this, you know, on the inside. I try and be cool on the outside, but it doesn't always come across that way. It kind of comes across as kind of like a tick or something. You know, like strange gestures with the hands and things.
Oh, okay.
You. But. S. Use it.
Well, yeah, you should see how many instruments I have. I try and use it, and I try and walk, and read, and...
T-O, Tom, W-A, I, oh, use it like Tom Waits does. All his ticks and everything.
Oh, yeah, I should. I should. It's, I think part of it is I tend to pick hard instruments to play, like the upright bass. It's really big, and there's no frets. And so, like, you have to have perfect, absolutely perfect muscle memory to get a note in tune, and I have a good ear. I don't have perfect pitch, but I have a really good relative ear, and so it drives me crazy. And so it's like I have to get my notes right and my, you know, like perfect intonation and perfect time
or
and perfect feel,
or for or forget the and forget the notes.
I forget the notes.
He means that in a positive way.
Oh, right.
Just forget the notes and let your body take over.
That's very good advice. You really should go into psychiatry. You're a man of many talents, I think.
I think
this is a total therapy session. I thank you so much. I need it.
I'm
saying president. For quite frankly,
it's funny. Frank is running for president.
Quite frankly, you got
funny
it.
You should mention it.
You know.
Thank you. I was thinking governor first.
It goes all the way to the top.
I know.
I
think we need a lot of help. I think you're the. Yeah. I think you're the man for the job.
I think.
He's
Frank
great.
Thinks he said I think big.
Yeah.
He's got my vote now.
I'm telling you.
I did. You did. C. O. U. Oh, Frank did counseling in the 70s for like 6-7 years.
Oh, wow.
He always says he's flexible.
Yeah.
And so his whole, he's always like the same, except what it looks like on the surface changes according to what people are into. So in the late 70s, mid to late 70s, people were, especially around here, people were into like growth and, you know, so there's a lot of therapy stuff. And so Frank did relationship counseling.
Wow.
And I mean, he was like, he was raking in the dough. I mean, he would meet with people like eight to 10 hours, 5 days a week, 2 hour sessions.
Wow.
And people, and he would, you know, charge them what they could afford. And some people could afford more than others. And so he was really.
Oh, my goodness.
Doing it.
Yeah.
And
definitely.
Then they, C, A, came in H, O, U, house, holds. Well, because as a result, he would do workshops too. So people would do the workshop. And so all these relationships formed and household formed. So, and then he'd have the whole household come at one time and deal with the relationship dynamics and the,
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. That's where the Outrageous Beauty Review came from, was all those various households. You know, had been working with Frank for all these years and,
oh my goodness,
and hanging
themselves
pretty loose, you know.
Wow.
So the show was just like, you know,
oh,
daily
fantastic
life, you know. Yeah.
Wow.
Unbelievable.
B.
Yeah.
For get the notes.
I'm going to work on that one because I think that's really good.
I.
That's really good.
P. L. A. I play piano. Frank plays piano, so he'll play when we do jams here.
Yeah.
That's what he'll play.
Oh, wow. Very many talents.
How you got started? Well, it's when we started doing the show. And that was a bunch of years ago, 7-8 years ago or something. And he would have these great musicians on, and he wanted to, like, play with them.
Oh,
so
my.
he would say, can I jam with you? I S A sang with H B L blues. That's kind of where it started. Big Willie, who's this amazing blues guy that would just sing on the streets in San Francisco, but he'd been doing it forever. And he shows up, we book him, and he shows up with his son. And Big Willie is like literally
Big
huge,
Willie, okay.
You know. And then, but he's like an amazing singer, and he's like, he's just down and doing like this, and Frank just starts singing with him. You know, you know, you don't know if he's gonna like it or not. Like, we totally loved it, and they're leaning into each other, and they're just like, you know, and they're really going at it. And I think that started encouraging Frank, you know, to kind of do stuff like that. And S. T. Stephen Kent, who is this didgeridoo player.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he, you know, he travels all over the world doing his didgeridoo. Wow. He's, you know, like a serious musician. Well, Frank says, can I jam with you? And they did this incredible jam, and Stephen loved it and was very inspired by it.
Wow.
And has played in Frank's band since then at Burnt Ramen, you know, this,
wow,
this high class didgeridoo player. So I think those kinds of things made, you know, Frank feel more confident about it. And then he started playing the piano. You know, I'd never done that before. And the musicians would like it. And they go, oh, wow, it's really good. They, C, A, came, not knowing. Well, we had many experiences where the musician would only have communicated with Frank by email, so had no idea that Frank was in a wheelchair or anything, and would say yes, that they would, he could jam with them, and then they'd walk in and see Frank. And, I mean, well, P, H, Phil,
Phil
Gelb was the most extreme one. He does new music, and he hosts at the time was hosting a series, and again, like a highbrow type of dude. And what did he play?
Shakuhachi.
And had said Frank could jam with him, and he never let on that he was freaking out inside. And we didn't know until he sent Frank an email after the fact. But well, he said yes to the jam, but he kept trying to end it, like, within, like, a minute, you know? And Frank is, like, really good at ignoring stuff like that. So, like, Mikey and I are dying, you know, because it was so tense in the room, and clearly Phil didn't want to do this and kept trying to stop.
Oh,
Frank's just like, you know, we're having a good time.
You're so funny.
But the thing was, Phil totally got lost in it and then, like, was just, like, blown out by the experience of it. He goes home, and he's up all night emailing his girlfriend in Japan about this transformative experience he had playing music with Frank. And that's how we found out about it. He emailed Frank later and talked us through this whole process. And
so you're still doing the therapy.
Exactly, you are.
Right.
They're good, man.
Four.
Wow.
Forget the notes. Forget the notes. Just J-A jazz is T is not A about the notes.
That's therapy right there. I could work with that for a couple of years. Jazz will be too.
What?
It'll take him a couple of years.
Wow, you're good.
You did. G. You did good tonight. For being afraid.
Thanks. Appreciate that.
Where? And next? Where do you perform? And
I go back to New York City Wednesday, and I have a show next Saturday.
In New York City.
In New York City. And then I'm upstate, like in Buffalo, Syracuse, Verona, the middle of October, and I don't know. Sometimes I don't even know where I'm going until I have to kind of look at the schedule and go, okay, that's where I am. That's where am I right now, and where am I going? I sometimes get too confused if I think too much about it.
How is the music? S. C. Scene in New York City.
Fantastic.
Fantastic. A lot different than here.
How so?
A lot different. I played New York a lot. We were just talking about this earlier, too. And so I'm a Californian, basically. I never thought, I've lived in LA, too. I played with Queen Ida for, it's been like 13 years now. And she hasn't been traveling half as much for the last couple of years. But in New York, there's just so much stuff happening in Manhattan. And I'm sure you can, there's probably, I'd say, in Manhattan, just in Manhattan, in that little island, which is like 14 miles wide and 3 miles wide, 14 miles long, 3 miles wide, right? There's probably about 150 real nightclubs, I would say, and probably another 300 or 400 clubs that are on and off, you know, that maybe only 3 nights a week. But here, I mean, in the whole Bay Area between Sacramento and Monterey, like I have a band and we play, and there's only, we've got it down to like 8 nightclubs, which is probably a high estimate of clubs where industry and where people would, what would be advantageous for us to play just to get seen by other people in the industry and just to network our stuff. And you've already been to 2 of them. And you've been here like 3 days. I mean, it's so bleak in the Bay Area compared to New York or Austin, Texas or other places. Like in Austin, there's probably 50 clubs that you can play at. You can actually make a living playing at clubs.
Wow.
Here, that's impossible.
Yeah, this is right. This show is becoming one of the stops for touring bands, and I think it's because of what you're saying that there's just not a lot around.
The internet, and you know, what's I'm sure you guys talk about this every day. I don't know if you're maybe even mentioning it probably, but like things like YouTube and Yahoo just started a video site day before yesterday, where you know, this is the new way that people network their stuff and get seen. When I was a kid, I played in nightclubs and bought 2 homes, playing 7 nights a week, playing cover tunes and just playing. Raised kids, bought homes, a whole bit, bought property in San Francisco. Playing in clubs and played with bands. I used to play with the Pointer Sisters. I used to play with all kinds of people. And we could make, there's ways out, you know, if you weren't working with a touring band, you could get a job playing in a club 7 nights a week. Not much money, but as you all know, that making steady money is better, is consistency.
Right.
You know, it's just like they say, is it inspiration or consistency that drive music? Well, probably there is some inspiration in consistency. You know, just to be consistent and good at what you do is probably as inspirational as, you know, in the long run, as being a Picasso. There's probably a little Picasso and everybody who just keeps doing it.
Yeah.
You know, so that's what's not happening anymore. You can be consistent as hell, but you're not going to make any money out here. So it's weird. It's changed. So now these shows and what's going on the web, other people can see you worldwide, and then maybe somebody in Stockholm or somebody in Nairobi or somebody say, well, we'd like to have this band play there.
F.
And you can open more channels that
you.
Way.
Funny.
Sorry for breaking on your shows.
Funny. We were A, about the first, right, when we started doing this, I never get the year, 7 or 8 years ago, I mean, there wasn't really anybody doing this, and we, to find out how to do it, we had to get computer nerds, you know, because it wasn't like you could just go and, like, you know, it wasn't like that, and you'd go to servers, and they didn't know what you're talking about to try to get somebody to host us and stuff. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, I made records like 10 years ago where we were the first people to put videos on CDs. Encrypted stuff so they could play it on Mac or PC.
Right.
And I had to go, there's a guy named Nels Johnson, the guy who wrote Director. And I had to find this guy to find out how to do that. This is like maybe 7 years ago.
Right.
The guy who wrote the programs that did tabletop video to find out how to encrypt a video on a CD.
Wow.
This is crazy.
We were the doing L lover L-I live video. Right, on the internet before, right at that point, 7-8 years ago, and there wasn't much of that around.
Nothing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. When they were S-A saying 3 M-I minutes. Oh, they said nobody's going to watch anything for more than 3 minutes on the internet. That's what people would always tell us when we said we do video. Because, Frank, we were like put all of our stuff up. Like, you know, we make movies. We got all our movies up there. We do our shows are all up in video. Nobody's going to watch anything that's more than 3 minutes on the internet, you know, but that turned out not to be true.
Well, the stuff's getting better, too, the download time, you know. Like
right.
If you look at something that's 20 minutes of information to download, it takes a while. Mm. You can do 3 minutes of information or 4 minutes, like maybe that's what they're thinking. It's easy. The stuff's getting better too. You can buy a PC at Costco now that'll do all this stuff. 10 years ago or 7 years ago, you're talking about a $25,000 rig to do that. Now it's maybe, you know, $900, right?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. People want think it T. takes a lot of money. That was the other thing we ran into when we started. It was it $99 a month to do? Well, because it started because Frank met a guy on the internet that was involved in an internet radio station called Fake Radio, and it was one of the first ones. It was a bunch of nerd dudes that put this radio thing on, and the guy that Frank met, Frank was out looking for, you know, nude websites, and this guy was this artist that did this nude thing with the two women that he lived with, Art Television, and had just been reading about Frank in Annie Sprinkle's book, because Annie lists Frank as one of her teachers.
Wow.
And so then he meets Frank, he's going, oh, yeah. And so he said he was doing this radio show, and Frank said, I've always had a fantasy of doing a radio show. He said, oh, you could do one here. They were about free speech. That's what they said.
Right.
Turned out what they meant was like you could curse, you know, but they actually had like a whole lot of limits on what you could do.
Goodness.
Frank's got like, he's like a master at honing in on what you're not supposed to do and then doing it. And so that's what he did. So right away we're in trouble. And he would do stuff like some of the DJs would say, I don't think anybody's listening. If I don't get an email in 5 minutes, I'm going to stop doing my show. So Frank would say on his show live, that people are doing this and that he thinks that that's not going to work. That it doesn't matter if no one's listening, because if someone tunes in and you're not doing anything, they're never going to come back. So he said, plus I don't think it's true that nobody's listening. And so then we'd get these classified chat room things from the management saying you can't talk about internal policy your show. So Frank would have me read that out loud, you know, as we're doing. Well, now we're getting a thing saying, you know. So, and then the last straw was the management. It was just like a couple of guys, you know, that like have day jobs and are doing this. But Frank said they had wet dreams of quitting their day jobs and getting a secretary and doing this internet station. Which Frank kept telling them it ain't going to happen. Just have fun. Just do it and have fun. I want to hear that. So, and then they started saying we have to sell out in order to maintain the station. So Frank said, well, what does that mean? Well, we have to get corporate sponsors. Sure, we'll have to change things a little bit, but it'll be worth it. Frank said, well, why don't you just get the DJs to chip in a little money? How much does it cost? A S as if, see, corporations would even do what they're saying. I mean, this is all abstract, you know. This isn't even true. And so they wouldn't tell us the amount. They wouldn't say it because they wanted to, like, keep the control and stuff. And so it started getting hot and heavy, and we were getting hate emails and, start your own station if you know so much, Frank, you know, which wasn't really what we wanted. We just wanted this nice little Sunday night slot because, you know, we had this all other, you know, we were doing this whole art thing that was like what we were mainly doing. And we were doing a zine that we were putting out, and it was just like we had like way more to do than we had time. Touring. But, you know, damn it. You just couldn't. Okay, so he said to Mikey, find out what would be involved. So this is, again, there's nobody around doing anything.
Goodness.
So Mikey had to learn in a week how to do it. We gave our notice. We didn't even skip a night. And we had this guy that we had met on the internet that was an artist in Tokyo. And so he was the first show on Lover, live from Tokyo, you know.
Oh,
and it was just his show and our show.
Oh, my goodness.
And that's how it started. The amount was $99. That's what they were selling out for. It cost them $99 a month to run that station, and that's what they said they had to sell out for. Because we found out when we did it ourselves, that's how much it cost, $99. So we pretty much...
It's not a lot of money. If I was going to sell it.
That's what Frank always says. Frank says, I'm willing to sell out. No one's ever offered me enough money.
I'll sell out right
now. $1 million. Yeah, it's got to be a lot of money to sell out. They were F-I-N finally C-L-C-O-N. They were conned. They've long stopped that other radio station. They were conned by somebody who said, you know, you pay us all this money and you'll be part of this network and you'll get all these listeners. And, you know, that was not true. And they're long gone.
Oh, dear.
And the guy actually came back and said, you were right about it all, Frank. And, you know, proof is that you're still going and going stronger and all that. But
congratulations.
Yeah.
So, are we wrapping it up? Okay.
Well, I want copies, whatever you got.
You want copies?
Sure, I want copies
of
everything, just like him.
Oh, he wants copies of everything, just like you. We should give your website out to people, too.
Oh, yes, yes.
Before, go ahead.
So, it's my name, which is Trossiana Graves. And before people get scared, like, how do you spell that? Is there a Z? Is there an X? What is that? It's TrossianaGraves.com. TrossianaGraves.com. And also at MySpace. MySpace.com/TrossianaGraves.
Or you could go to lover.com and you'll get all that information. I guess contact the bands is the easiest way to get it.
Yeah.
Under G for Graves.
We'll be there.
What do you do, by last name or first name?
We'll do her last name, right? When it's a double name.
Also G for Graves.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thanks, you guys are the best.
You are. We want to come back.
Yay! Okay, Eric, Dave, and Trustee.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you, thank you.
Seven, where, when, R, U, C, O, coming back. We'll work those details out.
Yes, we'll have to figure that out.
You went to the Bay Area?
Yeah,
go ahead.
Yeah, my website is studio4d8.com. www.studio4d8. I'll put it on there too.
Yeah.
Whatever it is.
Yeah. Dave?
I don't have a website. I don't have a card.
Dave.com.
Dave.com. He needs
fear.com.
Yeah.
He needs Mikey. M. He needs to do S E S S sessions with with me.
That's right. I do. It's him and I. We'd be a good team together.
Okay, so good night, everyone.
Yeah.
Good night. Thank you.
That's right. Thanks.